Chapter 15, The Chase, The Changeling, and The Chat. Today, Adam and Prometheus tore down the New York back streets, past fire escapes, dumpsters, and steam grates. Diana! Prometheus panted as he ran. That was Diana! I know. I'm sorry. I didn't think they'd find me so quickly. Pete turned on his friend with a face like thunder. You knew she was after you? He stopped running, grabbed Adam by the lapels of his golden coat, lifted him off the ground and slammed him against the brick wall of the alley. Do you have any idea how long I've happily been a sweet old man for? I'm sorry, I really... Adam began, his feet dangling off the ground. No, I don't think you fully understand. You think that you've got all the time in the world to get this done because you cannot die. But there are worse things than death. You can be imprisoned, driven mad, made to forget yourself until the last star dies. You've seen enough to know this. My brother spent generations wrapped in the entrails of his own son, with venom constantly dripping into his eyes. Mima is still just a talking head on some heavenly bookcase, Pete spat furiously. And me, if they get me, I'm back on the rock. I already spent hundreds, thousands of years on there for you. Adam looked down at the lined features of the usually pleasant old man, watching them contort with rage. Regret and, dare he feel it, fear coursed through Adam's body. I thought you'd want to help, was all he could muster.
Help? You selfish, single-minded fool! You've led a former goddess straight to me!
Pete's hands were shaking, but not with exhaustion. Adam could see it was taking every bit of restraint Pete had remaining to stop himself releasing more of his true power. You're right, I did, and I didn't tell you the whole truth. You're right to yell at me, but... Adam looked back down the alley through which they'd come. I think you should yell at me while we're running. Pete's head snapped round. Diana was sprinting towards them at full pelt. Seemingly uninjured, she didn't seem angry. She looked excited. Hungry. Without another word, Pete dropped Adam, and both men bolted from the terror closing in.
Why is she after you?
Asked Pete as they tore around a corner into another dark alleyway. I don't know, said Adam. I'm guessing it's the heaven thing. I didn't know she worked for management anymore, but it doesn't matter why she's after me, which means it's time to say goodbye. He looked down to the end of the side street. In front of them was another brick wall where they could turn left or right. She can only follow one of us, Adam said. It was lovely to see you. I'm sorry I ruined your life.
You really did, said Pete. Good luck.
Adam went right as his old friend turned left, neither taking a moment to chance one last look at each other. Diana reached the end of the alleyway. She pulled a metallic silver bow from her empty quiver. She glanced left and saw Prometheus. She looked right to see her quarry pulling away from her. She summoned her arrows, then reached back and grabbed the dark fletching. The arrow flew true, heading straight towards Adam's heart. It hit him hard. Diana saw the spot where her arrow hit. It rippled a bright gold before the arrow bounced harmlessly off Adam's coat. Praise be to Vulcan, Adam muttered. Getting the coat back before this had all kicked off was a very good move on his part, but he knew he couldn't outrun or outfight the former goddess for long. He needed to improvise, end this chase, and end it quick. He turned another corner, searching through the many pockets of his wonderful coat. Found it, a washed-out jam jar. Unscrewing the lid, he ran through a large cloud of steam coming up from a metal grate. The jar, now full of mist, he closed tightly and returned to its pocket.
Diana ran through the same cloud, her eyes sparkling with excitement.
Orion!
She screamed. There was a name Adam hadn't heard in a long time, but he stayed quiet, hidden. To Diana, the alleyway was empty, her prey nowhere to be seen. She sniffed the air. In a dumpster, Adam was frantically going through his pockets once more. He knew it was in here somewhere. He rummaged through his knick-knacks. A Kohaline druith, a wolfsagan, a never-ending porridge pot. Aha! He whispered triumphantly as his hand connected with a thick ball of yarn. Diana's ears pricked and her gaze fell on the dumpster. Adam began wrapping the yarn around his hand as fast as he could. Diana's hand reached for the lid. Adam stumbled through the Greek incantation he had memorized so long ago. The yarn began to glow. The lid flew open. Adam, summoning all his strength, hit the former goddess on the chin with his bound hand. Diana went flying. Adam climbed out of the bin and approached her, hopeful. He'd knocked out a demigod with this trick once before, but no such luck. Diana gave a little chuckle and propped herself up on one hand, wiping her face with the other. Another good hit, she purred, sounding rather like her mother. There will not be a third. The chase began anew. Adam began to unwind the yarn from his hand. Lake, find me a lake, he instructed it. There was only one way Adam was going to be able to escape Diana. He needed the sword. The yarn glowed, twitched, and then flew out ahead of Adam. He held tight and, as if with an overexcited dog on a leash, began to race towards what he hoped with all his heart was a lake. 10 blocks away, Pete was leaning against his own dumpster. His hands still shook as he rifled through different passports, wondering who he could be and where he could go that they might not follow.
Stupid boy! It's his own bloody...
But he was beginning to feel a little guilty about leaving his friend to face Diana's wrath alone. So intent was he on justifying his abandonment that he didn't notice the large frame in a chauffeur's uniform heading towards him.
He'll be fine.
Diana's chauffeur smiled broadly as he carefully removed his smart black hat, resting it on a nearby window ledge. His eyes were wet and shiny. His teeth were becoming too big for his mouth, sharpening into large fangs. There was a horrible sort of wet cracking sound, like that of bones being pulled repeatedly in and out of their sockets. Pete looked up to see the horrifying thing in the chauffeur's uniform fall onto all fours, the back of its jacket split as thick brown fur protruded. Pete watched the grim metamorphosis with a horrific sort of fascination. Nails became claws, mouth became muzzle, man became beast.
All I ever wanted to do was teach,
Pete mumbled piteously to himself. A hand fell on his shoulder.
I know you did, and you will again.
Pete turned to see an open-faced man in his mid-50s. His friendly face was framed by a neat crop of dark hair peppered with grey. He was wearing a maroon button-down, a white shirt, a black tie, brown khakis, and was sporting incredibly shiny brown leather shoes. It was a good disguise, but Pete would know his little brother anywhere.
But first, continued the man in a soft southern drawl, let's take care of our poor friend here.
The chauffeur's transformation was now complete. The werewolf bore its teeth and snarled at the two men.
Oh, look what she's done to your beautiful design. This is just sloppy work,
the man in the maroon said to Pete, sounding disappointed. Do you mind if I... He gestured to the beast.
Oh, no, sighed Pete, resigned. Go ahead.
Now that Lucy, or Nick, or Sam, or whatever his little brother was calling himself today, was involved, things were not going to go back to normal any time soon.
Bring him peace, said Pete.
He hung his head as Lucy stepped in front of him. The werewolf, who was not used to such a blasé reaction to his true form, charged at them. Lucy raised a hand as the beast leapt. Ashes to ashes. A blinding fire raged for a brief moment in the New York back street. Dust to dust. Lucy lowered his hand with a small smile.
Okay, let's get you out of here before the whole host comes for you. My car is waiting.
Lucy put his arm around his big brother, the sooty remains of the werewolf blowing around them. They walked past the window ledge where the wolf had left his smart black hat, and with his free hand, Lucy scooped it up.
Here, Charon,
Lucy said, throwing the headgear to a pleasant-looking man who was holding open the door of a long white hearse.
This will complete the look for you.
The slight man caught it with a flourish and popped it onto his head.
Very good, sir.
He turned to Pete. It is wonderful to see you again. It has been far too long.
It has, Charon, though I do wish it were under more peaceful circumstances.
Pete sighed as he lowered himself into the back seat of the car, closely followed by Lucy. Charon gently shut the door behind them. The interior of the car was very warm, but quite dark, the tinted windows keeping the morning sun at bay. A log fire blazed on a large screen in front of them. This, coupled with the dark wood panelling and green leather seats, made Pete feel like he was in a private members' club on wheels.
I see you're living well,
said Pete, admiring his new surroundings.
I can't complain. How's the boy?
Lucy grabbed a fistful of M&Ms from the bowl between them.
Oh, still heartbroken, but hopeful somehow.
Pete looked out of the window, wondering where in the city his friend was, if he still was in the city.
I'm afraid I was a little harsh on him just now.
Oh? What's he done now?
He broke into heaven.
Lucy beamed, crunching the chocolate shells in his mouth between his brilliantly white teeth.
Good kid. I'm sorry I missed him.
The car drove on.
Can you put me somewhere sunny this time? Pete asked.
He'd liked living in England, but it would be nice to be able to wear shorts again.
I'll do my best. Warm is my speciality. But first, there is a little matter we must attend to.
Lucy picked up a remote.
End of the world, is it?
Asked Pete.
Worse.
Lucy clicked the remote and the fire disappeared from the screen. A nightclub took its place. A nightclub where Lucy was looking back at them. He looked a far cry from the man he did now. The Lucy on the screen looked dishevelled, wearing a dirty, sandy brown suit. He appeared to have a black eye.
Thanks for the drink, Paul,
said the Lucy on the screen to a man at the bar.
Hey, get back on the horse. You're a catch.
Then he got up and started to walk away, before turning around with an intoxicated stumble.
What am I watching?
Pete asked, troubled. His little brother was always up to something.
Just watch.
Lucy gestured toward the screen, where his on-screen counterpart drawled on.
That's the other thing about love. It'll get you when you are least expecting it.
As the on-screen Lucy walked away, the camera panned to a private booth where three women sat, a blonde, a brunette, and a redhead.
Juno.
Pete leant forward.
Along with two of her daughters. They go by Anna and Amy now, finished Lucy.
Prometheus stared at the footage of his sister and his nieces. Juno looked as commanding as she'd always been. The beautiful, but now vacant-looking Amy looked as though she was carved from marble. Lovely, but cold. Pete remembered she used to feel so much. And then there was his favourite. Even though he knew uncles weren't meant to have favourites.
Anna.
How different it would have been if she'd sided with him and Lucy rather than her mother and father all those years ago.
Look, I honestly don't care what they're asking for. Just give it to them,
said the woman on screen, known to the world as June Friday.
I'm not sure they'll budge. Lucy, you know, he's been good to them, and we don't have anything concrete to offer. We knew a partnership with the Infernal Region was a long shot,
replied Anna. The screen froze.
Am I meant to have any idea what they're talking about? Pete asked his brother.
No, you are not. I'm about to explain it to you. I just thought you'd appreciate the visual learning aid. I know you like to use caricatures in your lectures.
Lucy smiled at Pete's questioning look, helping himself to more M&Ms.
I also thought you'd want proof. I know I've developed something of a reputation for tall tales. I wouldn't want to be accused of, what was it, slander?
Get to it, growled Pete.
Last week, one of Juno's ambassadors turned up at my place of work uninvited. They made my staff an offer, which they refused, naturally.
What offer?
It seems Juno's had enough of doing most of the work these last 2,000 years for, well, zero credit. She's planning a takeover.
Lucy said this matter-of-factly, as if he were describing the weather.
Oh, oh dear, said Pete, now reaching for the M&Ms himself. Has she forgotten the last time there was a revolution?
Never mind last time, Petey. Do you want her running the show? Better the egotistical sibling or the devil you know and all that. Who knows what she has planned for it all?
What are you so worried about? It's not like she'll actually succeed. Just cause a lot of noise and fuss. Maybe a natural disaster here and there. If she won't get past the gates, said Pete. He still has Michael.
Lucy's eyes flashed at the name.
Oh, yes. Well, Michael, former god of war, archangel in chief, guardian of heaven's gates, has gone AWOL.
Pete sat in shocked silence for a minute, winded by the news.
Where is he?
Pete finally stammered.
I have absolutely no idea. But I am assuming that these two sudden shifts in the cosmic tapestry are not unrelated.
Please, tell me you have a plan, Pete said. Come on, Lucy, you've always got something.
He tried to sound casual, even jovial, but there was a pleading tone to his voice.
Not so much a plan, Lucy chuckled, but an observation. I need you to tell me what it means, Professor. I have eyes and ears at all levels of Juno's organization. All of it's pretty normal revolution-type stuff, gathering allies, collecting magic, etc. But they are desperate, desperate to stop Adam. Now, why would Juno care not a jot for the Lord's petty order, and yet continue to obey this one ancient decree? She's seemingly ignoring all his other rules, which I do admire. Why would she dedicate so much of her resources in keeping Adam from Eve, if she's planning a hostile takeover anyway?
You think that keeping them separate is necessary for her plan to work? Pete murmured.
That, said Lucy, patting the top of Pete's head, is what I need your big, beautiful brain to help me figure out.
Well, I'll need to consult the literature.
Pete was always grateful for an opportunity to bury himself in books. He liked a puzzle. Having something specific to figure out would take his mind off the general ensuing mess.
I remember the days when we could keep the whole history of time in our minds, Lucy said wistfully, drawing a smiley face on the car window's condensation.
Oh, yes. When did it all become so complicated?
I think we only have ourselves to blame, said Lucy.
If it's literature you want, use my library.
Lucy leant forward.
Charon, the townhouse, please. My brother's going to do a little light reading before we blow him to Bermuda.
Very good, sir, nodded Charon. He indicated left and drove them on to the Devil's Home. Charon had heard Juno's offer. It had been tempting.
The benefits were good, and they would be recognized for their work again outside of myth, legend, and Halloween. But at the Hades Workers' Union meeting, they had all agreed it was best to stay out of the whole thing. If she failed, business would continue as usual, without any unpleasantness with the boss. Lucy had always treated them well. And if Juno succeeded, what was she going to do? Fire them? That would be foolish. After a war on heaven, there would be so many dead. Think of the paperwork. Charon doubted even Juno would want to spend her first day on the throne training up a new workforce. His train was about to get awfully full.
You've been listening to Evergreen, Chapter 15, written by Sam Russell and read by Catherine Russell. If you enjoyed this chapter, wherever you're listening, please subscribe, give us a rating and a review so we can get this story into more people's ears. And if you really enjoyed it and want to support this project, you can do so on our Ko-fi page. All details are available on our Twitter, @EvergreenBook1. The next chapter comes out on December the 27th. Thanks for listening.